So the moving music of the civil rights movement. I always feel like I need to explain my titles at the very beginning. And I'm almost... I sort of hope it annoyed some of you. It annoyed me a little bit after I decided on my title. Because when we talk about something being moving, we usually mean that it's affected us emotionally. Whether it's a film or a speech or a sermon or a painting, when we say we've been moved, we usually mean we've been moved emotionally. And sometimes we're moved by very, very good things, by images of moral excellence, or even deliverance from evil circumstances. These things can be moving to us. The problem is, it's very easy to be emotionally moved by music and do absolutely nothing. So the movement remains an internal experience only, inside. And there's a danger that that experience might become entirely self-referential. So I listen to this is something that I've done my whole life. I have a piece of music I love. I listen to it, and my eyes well up with tears, and I feel good about the fact that I'm shedding tears about that. So I'll turn it off, come back to it later, listen to it to shed another tear, and feel good about myself for being moved. It doesn't really have anything to do with anybody else at all. So it's great to be moved, but the real question is, moved to what? And are we moved in a way that changes anything in the world around us, or that helps anybody or benefits anybody other than ourselves? In the 1950s and 60s in this country, when people were protesting for the civil rights of African Americans, music played a very significant role as a form of protest. And that's really what I wanted to focus on tonight. My question is, in what sense did civil rights music help move people to action? And as a result, how did the music contribute to the broader movement? And many of these songs became known as freedom songs because of their involvement in the civil rights movement. And they had many functions, these songs. First of all, they were sung as corporate protest, as a proclamation of what was wrong in this country. In a similar vein, I think, to some of the Old Testament prophets, the role of the prophet was not just to predict the future, but to point out what was wrong right now, and to give an alternative vision for what God might have for right now. A lot of these songs had a message directed outward to whoever would listen. But one of the things that I've sort of found as I've been looking at this music is that they also had a very inward function. The freedom songs had a galvanizing and community strengthening effect within the movement. So it was music for the people singing, as well as for the onlookers, for the indifferent folks, for the politicians, for the police, for everybody. Music clearly did more than just affect people emotionally, didn't it? Civil rights protesters did not stay at home singing and feeling moved. People stood up and marched and boycotted and actively protested, often at great risk to themselves. And before I go any further, I just need to acknowledge that this topic is obviously one that's more than just historical interest. Because issues of racial injustice are far from resolved in this country. This past week, even as I was coming back to this lecture after not looking at it for a little while, within the last 4 days, two highly publicized fatal shootings of black men by white police officers. Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Philando Castile in St. Paul, Minnesota. The two most recent killings in a rash, I would say, over the past number of years. Shootings where white police officers have killed black men. And then just last night, snipers in Dallas, Texas, in retaliation for these deaths, opened fire during a protest rally, which actually was going about fairly peacefully, but targeting and killing five policemen. And I've been too busy preparing this lecture to keep up to date with what the latest on that, but five police officers were killed. The Black Lives Matter movement has risen up in response to this nationwide crisis, and I think all of these events are likely what come to our minds when we turn to the topic tonight, which is going back in time to the 1950s and 1960s, to the Civil Rights Movement. I feel a little bit like my dad did quite a few years ago when he planned a great lecture for a Friday night, and then September 11th happened on that Tuesday. So what do you talk about? Do you go ahead with your lecture that you were planning on doing? He totally, I'm not able to do what he did in terms of just, changing topics midstream, but I've been reflecting on that a lot as we talk about current events. We certainly can talk about current events a lot in the discussion time. I think it's actually quite an appropriate time to look back at the Civil Rights Movement and to learn what we can from that story and not forget that story. We're in a different sort of a story right now, but one of the things that's important to remember is what was accomplished by peaceful resistance in the Civil Rights Movement. And I was talking to Dick earlier today, and he was reflecting that what if the Civil Rights Movement under the leadership of Martin Luther King had begun with an event like last night? If that was the tone that was set in terms of violently targeting police officers, it would not have been the same story, and we would not be where we are today. It would have been a very, very different and much more bloody story. And so I think this is the time for many of us, and should be for most of us, where we are angry and we are upset, and we need to talk about it, and we need to pray hard to God. And that's what I'm going to do right now. I'm going to pray, and then we're going to move on to the topic for tonight. And hopefully, throughout the course of the talk, questions and issues and things that you want to raise will come up, and then we can talk about them in the discussion time. Let's pray. Our God, we thank you for your goodness, and that there is such a thing as justice, even if we don't often see it acted out or embodied. We thank you that there is such a thing as justice, and you are real. You, the one who cares about justice more than even any of us, and one day will bring about perfect justice. This is the great Christian hope for all believers throughout all time. And we ask for faith in that reality now as we talk about and reflect on difficult circumstances. Give us love and unity and faithfulness to you. In your name we pray. Amen. So, I'm a musician, and I studied ethnomusicology in college, which has gotten me into trouble when I do LaBrie lectures sometimes. But there's a whole lot of different kinds of music in the Civil Rights era that actually contributed to it. Tonight, I just want to acknowledge I'm not going to be paying attention to a lot of it. Just for the sake of time, I'm going to be focusing more on music that came out of black churches in one way or another. I will refer to the black church quite a lot, but it's important to realize that that is no one thing. The black church is not a homogenous entity now, and it never was, any more than the white church is one thing, right? So I will use that term, but fairly loosely, and I just want everyone to understand that can mean a whole lot of different things. There's a lot of diversity within black churches, socioeconomical diversity, cultural, political, and musical diversity. More so, though, than any of the other kinds of music at the time, black religious music, which included some very, very old Negro spirituals, as well as newer gospel songs, was really a driving force in the Civil Rights Movement from within and on the ground. And songs that were sung corporately before and during and after marches, during freedom rides, any preparation for the crossing of the segregation line, very often gospel music was what was sung, mostly music coming out of the black church. So I'm interested in that. I'm interested in why that is. And gospel music is a topic that's close to my heart. It's been a huge spiritual encouragement to me over the years. For many years, I worshipped at Greater Framingham Community Church. There's some people from GFCC here tonight. I'm glad you're here. That was my church throughout high school and into college and the years after college. And my faith was very nourished at that church. And I learned a lot about gospel music at that church and was stretched as a musician at that church also. To my horror, I was expected to participate in the music, and I was sort of wanted to hide a little bit, and I wasn't allowed to, and I was thankful for that, actually. One of the things that slowly dawned on me is that with a lot of gospel music, you realize that it's born out of suffering and born out of struggle, and yet, ironically, it seems capable of expressing a fuller and more authentic kind of joy than a lot of other church music, at least I have heard. In my experience, the joy, I think, is authentic because it is not a result of pretending things are better than they are, right? And it's a joy that's rooted in what is true, even though things are as bad as they are. That's the kind of joy I think that we hear in a lot of gospel music. There's nothing naive or sentimental about it, and so it's a joy that can be trusted. Some of the joy I hear in church music, and I'm not really sure whether to trust it, you know. But I've come to trust gospel music over the years. But I'm definitely conscious of tonight being pretty removed from my topic in at least three ways. I'm a white guy. I will be reflecting on a very particular struggle in America that has not been my own personal struggle. Secondly, I'm relatively young. Not too young, but relatively young. And All of the music and events that I want to talk about tonight happened long before I was born. I think my earliest memory of racially motivated violence was the Rodney King incident in L.A. in 1991. That's about as far back as I can remember, and even that was quite removed from me. I was on the other side of the country and quite young and didn't understand what was going on. And thirdly, I'm from the north, and I've always have been from Massachusetts, and so there's a lot of the events we're going to be talking about happened south of the Mason-Dixon line. I don't want to completely disqualify myself from having anything to say tonight, but I do want to say thank you for those of you. So I'm going to sit down now. But I am thankful for those of you in the room who are closer to these events. Those of you African American folks, people who are old enough to remember some of these events, I value your input and your insights and your memories. So I'm going to start by giving a very, very inadequate and brief timeline of what most people call the civil rights movement, sort of spanning from the mid 1950s to 1960s, end of the 1960s. You could call it sort of a view from 30,000 feet up. But I think it's important for context, because we're going to be talking a lot about music, and we want to talk about actually some of the historical things that were happening when these songs were being sung. This is quite a wonderful photograph, actually, of Martin Luther King, Coretta Scott King, and a number of other people singing and walking together. I apologize for the small type. I wanted to get it on one screen. But so starting in the period of Reconstruction after the Civil War, throughout much of the South, there were local and state laws passed to enforce segregation of black and white people. And these became known as Jim Crow laws. And there was segregation in every sphere of public life. And so if you can think of anything to do with public life, it was segregated. Public schools were segregated, public parks, public transportation, public restrooms, drinking fountains, restaurants, church, of course, segregated. Many white people insisted that segregation, the separation of blacks and whites, was necessary and did not imply any inequality. But it was obvious to anyone, actually, living in these places, that Jim Crow laws were basically a way of perpetuating gross inequality and of legitimizing violence against black people. So keeping black people separate was a way of ensuring that they would never receive the same opportunities as white people. Opportunities of education, housing, employment, everything. In 1954, this is coming to my slide here, 1954 was the Supreme Court case Brown versus the Board of Education, in which the Supreme Court struck down this separate but equal principle when it came to schools. So segregation in schools was illegal by decree of the U.S. Supreme Court starting in 1954. But this was just the very, very beginning of a struggle to actually implement and enforce federal desegregation laws in states that didn't want to respect them. So it's all very well to have a new federal law, and those were important things to fight for. But if on the local level there's no enforcement of that federal law, in fact, if every local official does their best to undermine the implementation of that federal law, then the federal law becomes a mockery and everything stays the same. And that was the situation. So in 1955, the Montgomery bus boycott began when Rosa Parks was put in jail for refusing to give up her bus seat to a white passenger. This is the end of a long day. She was tired. She didn't feel like getting up and moving to the back of the bus to surrender her seat to a white passenger, which was the expectation. And she refused, and she was arrested and put in jail for it. Because of that particular moment in history and the particular person she was, this event actually kicked off and started a momentum in the civil rights movement that hadn't been gained before. It was a key moment because she was a person who was very, very dignified, law-abiding, nothing, she was without fault, basically, except for this one thing she did, which was not get up and give her seat away. And so there was quite a lot of national sympathy. And this is something I've heard my old pastor, Reverend Lloyd, say, which is when Rosa Parks sat down and Martin Luther King stood up. So this is one of the things that kicked off the civil rights movement in a more practical way than it had before. And so black people in Montgomery boycotted the bus system and just carpooled and walked to work and did everything except ride the bus, and that actually had an economic impact on the bus system. In 1957, the Southern Christian Leadership Convention was founded. It goes by SCLC, and that was an organization whose first president was Martin Luther King. And the next decade or so, it began a decade of marches and freedom rides, boycotts and sit-ins and protest rallies and all kinds of ways of protest. In 1960, and so the SCLC was active throughout that whole time. In 1960, Ruby Bridges attended William France Elementary School. In Louisiana in 1960, schools had been legally desegregated for 6 years. Remember, 1954 is when the federal law went through. But only one black child in her family had the courage to go to the previously white school and face mobs of angry people. First of all, to even qualify to go to the local school, black children were given extremely challenging exams. And Ruby Bridges was one of the few kids that passed the exam, and then the decision was, do we send our daughter to this school? It's right down the street, right? It's in our district. But it's a school that had been historically only white. And she had been driving miles away to go to a black school. So this is an example of leadership, I think, of a whole family, but particularly of this girl who was 6 years old at the time. Every white student was pulled out of the school by their parents in protest. So Ruby Bridges went to school alone every day. In order for the law to really be enforced, she had to be escorted into school every day by federal marshals, not by local law enforcement, right? the local law enforcement would not have escorted her. But federal marshals had to come in and make sure she got to school safely every day. Also, in 1960, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, there's a lot of long organization names, SNCC, was formed. And this is an organization of students and mobilized by students throughout the country. And it proved to be really, really important organization in the years to come, particularly in the area of sit-ins and voting registration. So sit-ins were actually one of the most effective nonviolent forms of protest throughout this whole period. Basically, what a sit-in is, if you have people that go to an establishment, with usually a restaurant or something like that, that says no colored people allowed, you go in and request service. And when you're denied, you just sit down and wait. And that was what these four students in Greensboro, North Carolina, did. They just sat down and waited. And did their best not to retaliate in word or action to the humiliation and abuse that they would receive. This photograph is really interesting because the guy serving behind the counter is also an African American. So he wondered the situation he's in right now, right? He would certainly lose his job, at least, if he served them. So, here's another photograph. There's lots of amazing photo documentation of the Civil Rights Movement. It's worth just going and spending a couple hours. Just look. This next photograph is a really scary one. This picture disturbs me. I mean, there's one guy sitting there all alone, and he's surrounded. But this is what a sit-in is. This is the first sit-in happened in Greensboro. These four students did this in 1960, and that became there was a lot of momentum to this whole way of protests. It happened a lot. The SNCC was also hugely influential with voter registration, and here again, I think there's a discrepancy between the federal laws on the books and then the local laws that were actually implemented on the ground. Black men, not women, but black men had had the right to vote since the 15th Amendment was passed. That was in 1869. 90 years later, throughout much of the South, it was made impossible for any black person to even register to vote. And there's all kinds of methods that kept people from registering to vote. Sometimes there were special voting registration taxes that were only applied to African Americans. Black people were required to have a sponsor sometimes who was already a registered voter. That was mentioned actually in the movie Selma. That was something that one of the characters spoke about in the movie Selma. What do you do if you need a sponsor who's already a registered voter and you don't know anyone who's a registered voter? See, this is just designed to prevent anybody from being able to actually register. The most common thing was very, very complex registration exams were required, asking detailed legal information about the state constitution and things that nobody really would know. Also featured in Selma, the very first scene. So the effort to push through new federal legislation, that was just one necessary battle to fight, but there were a lot of other battles going on simultaneously. So to get the federal government to commit to exercising its power over local governments, that was one battle to fight, and actually bring local governments into compliance with federal law. That's a totally different kind of battle than just getting a new federal law, right? And this is one of Martin Luther King Jr.'s great struggles through the work of the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. But there was also the task of encouraging African-American people, especially in the rural South, to try to exercise the rights that their government theoretically had granted them. That's a different battle. Voter registration was one of the key agendas of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the SNCC. And they had a very, very difficult task coming into some of these rural towns. How do you get someone to go to the courthouse and register to vote when they know they will likely lose their job, lose their home, and endanger their family by doing it? How do you get someone to do that? It's a very, very tough sell, right? But this was the task that a lot of the civil rights workers were up against. If you were even seen speaking to a known civil rights worker, you could get into trouble. So how did that work? It was a long, long, hard, on the ground struggle. And I think it's really hard to overstate this, but there's this immense pressure on people to keep quiet, let sleeping dogs lie, leave things the way they've always been, sit down, go back to the status quo. Too much at stake by standing up and demanding a change. So those are just some of the kinds of battles that were going on all at once. Federal legal fight, getting the federal government to actually enforce the laws that they have theoretically approved of, and then trying to encourage people to go and register, which was a dangerous thing to do. In 1963, Medgar Evers, who was a NAACP worker, was murdered. And that was a very publicized event and caused a national outrage. Also in 1963, on August 28th, there was the March on Washington. And I'm just going to go back to my timeline here, sorry. March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, it was called. This is 250,000 people congregating around the Lincoln Memorial on the Mall in Washington, D.C. It was the centennial celebration of Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, so when he freed the slaves. It was 100 years later, and it was an acknowledgement of that centennial. Many, many civil rights leaders took part in that day, but it's most famously known for Martin Luther King's speech in which he says, "I have a dream." The agenda was equal opportunities for jobs. That was the main agenda, but there was all kinds of other things going on that day. Sorry, back to my timeline. In 1963, November 22nd, just a few months later, John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and the following year, after his assassination, the Civil Rights Act, which he had been trying to push through, was passed. And this involved all kinds of different things, but protecting African Americans against discriminating voter registration tactics was one of the things, outlawing discrimination in hotels, motels, restaurants, theaters. It gave certain powers to the Attorney General's office to file legal suits to enforce desegregation. Again, a legal battle was won there, but in terms of implementation, what was happening on the ground, that was a different story. If I can turn my page, I'll continue. In 1965, the march from Selma to Montgomery was planned. It was a peaceful demonstration. Martin Luther King and many other civil rights workers were involved with it, but it was brutally broken up. But unlike some of the other events that were brutally broken up, this one was widely televised. And suddenly it was totally on the national, the nation's conscience. Particularly the fact that nobody who was marching was resisting with violence in any way at all. The violence was completely one-sided. And so there was and that was intentional, right? That was not an accident of fate. That was something that people were intending to do going into this. Don't lift a hand in retaliation. And because it was so widely televised, there was this very, very clear sort of moral high ground that these people had. And so it sparked a huge amount of sympathy throughout the country, and was a significant part of what sort of twisted Lyndon B. Johnson's arm to pass the Voting Rights Act in 1965. He signed it into law, in large part as a response to this event. The movie Selma again sort of highlights that quite a bit. Skipping ahead to 1968, April 4th, Martin Luther King was assassinated. And 7 days later, on the 11th of April, Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, or Fair Housing Act, it's called, as the nation was descending into riots in response to Martin Luther King's assassination. So this is a messy, messy road here. Two major acts, the Civil Rights Acts, passed in part due to, in response to assassinations. not alone, but that certainly seemed to have been an influencing part. Now I want to slow down now and look at one day, and I'm supposed to talk about music tonight, so I'm going to and look at just one snapshot of a very iconic moment in the story, and that's the March on Washington. Just as a place to start, because there's so many things to talk about. I need to start somewhere. This was an event in which music actually played a very, very important role, maybe even a central role. And I'm just going to go through the list of some of the names of people who sang throughout the course of the day. Mahalia Jackson, perhaps the best-known gospel singer of all time, called the Queen of Gospel Music, recorded more songs than I know, a lot of recording. Personal friend of Martin Luther King, actually sang at his funeral 5 years later. And it was claimed, I think credibly, I've heard in various different places, this is her singing at the Lincoln Memorial, that in the middle of Martin Luther King's speech, Mahalia Jackson said to him, "Tell them about the dream, Martin." And from that moment on, King seems to have abandoned his prepared notes and launched into the part that we all know so well about the dream. And if you watch the video of this, you can see this moment where he kind of stops looking at his notes. And so Mahalia Jackson must have heard him speak about the dream before, and we may have her to thank for that moment. Who knows? She sang the spiritual, "I've been buked and I've been scorned." Buked meaning rebuked, and scorned. And then she also sang the gospel hymn, "How I Got Over." And I'm going to play a recording of that song right now. It's not a recording of her at the Lincoln Memorial. It's a better recording, so we can hear it a little bit better in terms of what she was actually singing. But
how I got over, how did I make it over? You know my soul, back in wonder, how did I make it over? How I made it over? How did I make it over? Tell me how we got over, Lord. Had a mighty hard time coming over. Know my soul back in winter. How did we make it over? Tell me how we got over, Lord. Oh, thank my Lord, I kept me and go. and that you do. I better walk the streets of gold. It's in that homeland of the soul. I'm gonna do the host and wife. They've been traveling day and night.
Jackson. Awesome singer. So much in this song that we could just sit and talk about, but it is actually later on I want to turn back to the song and look at some of what that meant in the context of a Lincoln Memorial as opposed to in church, right? This is different place, different context. One of my favorite moments in that song is she talks about the angels watching over me, and then early this morning God said, touch her. That's the only reason any of us get up, right, in the morning? Other singers that sang on that day. That was just Mahalia Jackson. Marian Anderson sang, he's got the whole world in his hands. Joan Baez, the white folk musician, sang "Oh Freedom," which is actually a Negro spiritual. She sang it in a white folk musician sort of way. But I'm just going to play a little bit of that. I won't play the whole song, but just to give you a sense of the diversity of music that was on stage that day.
Over me.
That was Joan Baez singing that song. That's one of the interesting things about the way she plays it is the time signature. It's in 6/8, so it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So this sort of rolling kind of feel to it. I did not warn anybody who walked into the room tonight, but would you all be willing to sing some songs tonight? Okay. So why don't we just briefly sing a version of this song of Freedom. A different kind of feel coming out of the Black Church, most likely, than what we just heard. So, strategies for not having anybody fall asleep tonight is periodically make you sing. It doesn't work with every lecture, but it's all right. So that scrawny guy over there is Bob Dylan, and he also sang on that day, "When the Ship Comes In," which is kind of this Woody Guthrie influenced protest song, and then "Only a Pawn in Their Game." Is anybody familiar with that song, "Only a Pawn in Their Game," which is a song specifically about the murder of Medgar Evers, which had happened only 2 months earlier. So Dylan was known for writing songs in direct response to events that had just happened. And it's an interesting song because it's really about sort of he's broadening the responsibility for that murder. It's not just about the poor white man that hated black people and shot Meg Rivers. It was about the rich white folks and the politicians who it was in their best interest to keep the poor white folks hating black people. Mm. If you think you're better than black people, then you're not going to demand much of me. So it's a very troubling song, but it's the pawn in their game is the murderer, the guy who actually pulled the trigger. He's just a pawn in a much bigger game, a much deeper systematic problem than just one man that wanted to kill somebody. Anyway, amazing. I'm not going to listen to it tonight, but go and listen to it. Peter, Paul, and Mary sang that day also. Interesting that they sang a Dylan song. And a couple other things. Odetta. who was a African-American folk singer. She sort of defied a lot of categories. She wasn't really a gospel singer. It wasn't coming directly from the church, but was a folk singer and loved American folk music and was coming from that. She had a degree in music and studied opera, but was really drawn to folk music. And then the Freedom Singers, we're going to actually, if all goes well, watch a video of them in a few minutes. They helped lead the whole group of people, along with Joan Baez, they helped lead the whole group of people singing We Shall Overcome. And they also sang the gospel song We Shall Not Be Moved, which is another one we'll listen to in a little while. So there may have been other people, but anyway, even if just the people I've mentioned, it's a lot of music, right? And the songs were not chosen to entertain people or provide relief from the intensity of all the politically charged speeches. They were part and parcel with the movement. They were sort of driving home and reinforcing everything that was being said. They were actually protest in song form. That's what was happening. And we can already see that there's a lot of different musical threads contributing. There's white musicians who were part of the folk revival. Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, Peter, Paul, and Mary. Pete Seeger wasn't there that day, but he was very much a part of the movement. He's one of the people that made We Shall Overcome such a well-known song. Most of these people were young, fairly socially conscious men and women, and were sort of swept up in the movement. And like I said a minute ago, Dylan had made a habit of writing songs in response to events that were happening. I think these musicians, the sort of white musicians from the folk revival, were important in that they helped raise the consciousness of people who were ignorant about the harshest realities of Jim Crow South. A lot of white Northerners kind of started to get a sense of what was going on because they were listening to this music, and it was more accessible to them. It's important to note, though, that even for these white folk musicians, often they were singing songs that came from the African American tradition. Right? So they were the Joan Baez one, for instance. So I'm going to turn now to music that was coming from the black church tradition and looking at specifically that whole thread of music. And I want to kind of explore the question, what was it that made it so perfectly suited for the civil rights movement? How did praise songs become freedom songs? Seemingly pretty smoothly. Like, they didn't take a lot of messing with the songs. And there are many ways to answer this question. I'm just going to sort of launch in, and this is a Labrie lecture, so I have to talk about theology just a little bit. One answer to that question, how did praise songs become freedom songs, is the theology that was in the songs. And this is true, actually, going back to the very earliest Negro spirituals during the time of slavery. There seems to be a refusal to view freedom in strictly spiritual terms, in only spiritual terms. All the language about heaven and the promised land and crossing over Jordan, these were certainly references to the next life, to dying and going to be with God in heaven, but they were not only that. And so there was an awareness that freedom in this life mattered to God as well. Not just freedom, the freedom of dying and going to be with God. The body and not just the soul matter to God. The freedom of the body and not just the soul matter to God. The freedom of the hereafter and the freedom of the here and now are two different things, but one implies the other. God is so excited about me being free with Him in heaven, then doesn't He want me to be free now too? And obviously, no slave could sing about running away to the north, right? But many of the spirituals were rich with double meanings. Double meanings that were not always picked up on. But just some of the most well-known spirituals that most of us probably know. Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, Go Down Moses, Wade in the Water. These all sort of references to sort of crossing over from slavery to freedom, literally crossing the river. There's a lot of evidence to show, and I'm not going to get into the evidence, there's a lot of evidence to show that it, in the minds of many people, these were just as much about freedom now as they were about the freedom of the soul after death. At least that was one of the implications there. While many slaveholders, and this changed, there's a lot of interesting research on this topic, but their slaveholders' attitude towards Christianity and their slaves varied quite a lot from time to time, depending on what they thought it was doing, right? At various times and places, slaveholders thought Christianity would improve the behavior of their slaves, make them more obedient and more manageable. Slaves believing in the freedom of the soul might make them more content with their condition now. Potentially. At least that was the hope for many slaveholders. But there was, in many cases, a nagging fear that slaves might just apply the story of the Exodus to their own situation, right? It's right there. Central story in the Bible. It's not hiding. Where the God of the universe heard the cries of the enslaved people and didn't simply save their souls for heaven, but busted them free, literally. intervened dramatically, showing his power, freeing his people and bringing destruction on Egypt. So that's right there in the Bible, and you can be sure that that made some slaveholders uneasy. Actually, it's one of the what slaves would do with the Bible was one of the main questions that slaveholders had in mind as to whether to teach their slaves to read. What are they going to do when they read the Bible? So interesting history, disturbing, but worth looking into. The spirituals came out of this very distant past, but one of the things that I think the Jim Crow laws proves is that things had not really changed a whole lot. Obviously, some things had changed, but in a technical sense, slavery was over, but in actuality, a lot of the same dynamics were in play, particularly when you look at the plight of a lot of sharecroppers who were, there's no way of getting out of debt. They didn't own their land. They didn't even own the seed that they were planting. And it was just a perpetual, technically not slavery, but very close. And so the songs born out of slavery, unfortunately, still applied in the 1950s and 60s, right? It wasn't a foreign concept. And so these songs were called freedom songs. Freedom was still something that was to be achieved. So in a similar way to the spirituals in slave times, to many Christian people protesting in the 1960s, there was not an artificial separation between theological concerns on the one hand, things that God cares about, and then political concerns of the moment on the other hand. There was not an artificial distinction between freedom of heaven and the importance of defending our rights now. And it's important to remember that Martin Luther King, he didn't actually represent the whole black church here. Martin Luther King was to many people, was considered too radical. He was obviously an amazing leader of the people that wanted to stand up and protest. But he was stirring up a lot of trouble. And even from within the African-American communities, he wasn't embraced by everybody. So that's just a nuance that we have to put out there. Let me see here. This is, again, a picture of Mahalia Jackson singing at the Lincoln Memorial. It's an interesting photograph because Martin Luther King is leaning in over here listening. But if we skip forward to this day, 1963, when Mahalia Jackson sings How I Got Over, which is a gospel hymn composed in the late 1800s or early 1900s. It's a church song, right? But Mahalia Jackson has lifted it from its church context and she's performing it in the context of the political struggle. So the context has changed. The song is the same. She doesn't alter it. She doesn't do anything to the lyrics. She sings the song. But the context is different, and so the meaning is different. Not totally changed, but there's another layer of meaning added, I think. The song is about a journey. It's mostly looking to God's faithfulness in the past, how I got over. It's acknowledging that we have come a long way already. And how did that happen? The answer is clearly God's faithfulness. God did not abandon us, right? He brought us through. It's also a future-oriented vision of all the nations coming together. The host dressed in white from every nation, right? So this is another thing to remember in the context of this. But on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, it's clear that it's not just a journey of the soul to heaven, or even a journey of struggling to survive hardships in life or resist temptations or other spiritual types of battles. The political struggle is brought right into the story of the song. The political struggle is now a part of the journey of walking with God. So she sings How I Got Over. It's both a proclamation to the opponents of civil rights that they're fighting against God. That's maybe the most revolutionary thing that she's doing by singing that song there. God's on our side. If you want to resist what we're doing, you're resisting God. In a similar way to, I was just reading the book of Acts the other day when the Pharisee Gamaliel says, you know what, let's not imprison, I forget who it is that's imprisoned at the time. I think it's Peter and John. Let's not imprison them because if we do, if this is of human origin, it'll fail. But if God is with them, then we're going to be fighting against God, and that's bad, right? So, anyway, that's one implication by taking this gospel song and placing it on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. But it's also, and this is something I'm going to talk about more later, but it's also a word of encouragement to the people within the movement that we have come a long way. Keep going. Don't forget who brought you this far. Because the God who brought you this far is still with you, and He's on your side as you protest the injustice right now. And so it's this proclamation to the people who are resisting civil rights, and it's a word of encouragement to people who are fighting for civil rights. And so the song is not in any way robbed of its older meaning, of its more sort of spiritual meaning, so to speak. Its older meaning is deepened and enriched and given flesh. So it applies now to this, right now. The rules don't change from one world to the next. So God's final future redemption should actually shine backwards into the present. Because if that's what He cares about then, that's what He cares about here. And so it's actually, if this is your theology, then it's deeply appropriate to sort of unleash gospel music as a protest, I think. It's not out of place. So the music, I think, helps cement a connection between the present struggle for equality and the concerns of the God of the Bible. And that's something that I think was happening all along the way. Whenever people sang gospel songs, that's what it was doing, cementing a connection between the struggle right now and what God cares about. But Mahalia was a soloist. She was singing alone. And actually, that's not typical of a lot of this music. Most of it was corporately sung together. Most of it was people singing together. And that's another reason why gospel music actually was so well suited for the civil rights movement. A lot of music has mass appeal. You think if you just listen to the pop radio station of your choice today, millions of people know those songs. But not all music can be effectively sung together by a big crowd of people. Right? Think of your favorite pop song, then think of 400 people trying to sing it together. So it's not always going to work, just technically speaking. But this music was coming out of the church in which it was always sung together. And so with the Freedom Songs, I think no one had a passive relationship to the music, and this was really in due because the singing came from the church. In many black churches, there's a spirit of participation when it comes to all of worship, to the preaching. If the choir begins to sing, this is my experience going to GFCC for the first time years ago. If the choir starts the selection that they have rehearsed and planned, and if anyone in the congregation knows it, they'll start singing very often. And to me, as someone who I've never been to a black church before, I was in high school, I was like, what's going on? Like, is this okay? Like, it was a surprise to me, like, they rehearsed this, we should listen. But it was clearly not just okay, but expected, right? If you know this, you participate, and the choir wasn't offended, and this was normal. So no one needed to be told to sing along if they know the song and if they feel moved by the Spirit to participate, right? And I think this fact alone made church songs practically very, very useful in the marches, in the civil rights movement. There was a vast shared repertoire of songs from people all over the country and knew a lot of the same songs. And many people knew them all by heart, so you didn't have to pass out pamphlets or lyric sheets or hymnals. The tradition was such that songs were kind of in people's bones. Even the songs that were unfamiliar to some people, because a lot of the people joining in with these marches were white folks or people from the north, and but a lot of the songs were accessible enough, simple enough, so that once everybody started singing, you could join in. And that's a great strength to the song, to how they functioned. This is the case that happened many, many times. It's written about that on bus rides, on freedom rides, when people are maybe taking a busload of people to go and register to vote, someone in the crowd would take up a song, and then everyone else would join in. And because of this, in a strange way, good gospel singers, most of them women, became leaders in the movement. Because that was an important aspect of leadership, actually. If you could sing well and get people singing, it was a huge asset, right? Especially when people were discouraged and afraid. If you could get people singing together. And this was the case with someone named Fannie Lou Hamer. The more I read about Fannie Lou Hamer, the more of a hero she becomes to me. She was eventually became a nationally known civil rights leader, but was also known for her singing. And she and her husband were sharecroppers in Ruleville, Mississippi, which was in Sunflower County, which by most people's accounts was probably the most racially oppressive county in the whole country, where most African Americans were sharecroppers, and there was absolutely no opportunity to be anything else. She was one of the first people to step forward when the SNCC came to her town to encourage voter registration. Remember how hard it was to get people to step up and register to vote, given everything that was at stake. She was one of the first people to step forward in her town. Her application was denied, of course, but she was kicked off her plantation where she lived and worked, just for trying to register. But rather than giving up, she became more and more determined to work for the voting rights of black people in Mississippi. So from that day forward, there was no turning back for her. She had stepped off the plantation and was not going back. So she worked for the SNCC for years afterward and became really a champion of voting rights in the civil rights movement. One of the things Fannie Lou Hamer would always do at the beginning of a meeting was sing and get people singing. And her favorite song to sing, I'm just going to give you another picture, this is her singing with some other people behind her. She was quite short, but she had a presence, evidently, and a voice which demanded attention. Her favorite song was This Little Light of Mine. And it's actually the name of her biography, which is which is upside down, which is worth reading, just for both autobiographical information about her, but a lot of stuff about the civil rights movement in Mississippi particularly. It's a strange choice to me, This the Light of Mine, mostly because I think of it as a kid's song somehow. And then maybe I'm wrong in thinking that, but a children's song, there's sort of a simplicity and an innocence to it. And yet, this was her theme song. This is her song. She sang it like every time she came to a meeting. And it was a way of preparing people to head into dangerous and humiliating situations. Jail, physical, verbal abuse, whatever they may experience. She would sing that song as a way of preparing people. One observer who was a good friend of hers, I think Eleanor Holmes Norton, she said, "Nobody sang This Little Light of Mine as Fannie Lou Hamer sang it. I'm convinced she chose that song for a reason. That she knew it summarized her life. All she was a light. And she fastened upon the notion that every little light can make a difference. The reason she fastened upon it, I think, is that she saw walking off that plantation had made a difference. That one little act had made a difference." So, if you're familiar with the song, it's and didn't know that it was associated with the civil rights movement, which I didn't really know that until I started reading about it, how do we hear that song differently in the context of civil rights? To me, it has a lot more weight. What's the light? I guess the question is, what's the light? What's the light she's thinking about, right? And it's certainly the light of the gospel, sharing the good news about who Jesus is with the world. But it's not just that. The light of God's justice and truth. Letting that light shine by trying to convince the nation that it's broken and things need to change. They cannot continue. So she's, in a sense, shining a light on a problem. That's one way that light functions. It's a light that reveals evil things that are done in the dark. It's the light of encouragement, I think, to Northern volunteers who were starting to wish they had stayed home. Or to Native Mississippians who felt that the status quo might be safer. Rather than risking trying to register to vote, maybe just go home. Anyway, these are all the ways in which I think she viewed the light, this light that she was going to let shine everywhere. She was so committed to black people participating in the political process that she did a lot of things. One of the things she did was get people from some northern city to ship her a vast quantity of clothes, and she would distribute them to poor people as long as they first tried to register. So she was just the shameless kind of like, show me that you tried to register to vote and then you're going to have these clothes. She also, along with several other black women from her county, or maybe from different areas, different districts in Mississippi, ran for Congress. This is actually a poster. It's not a very good photograph of it. It's kind of blurred, but with absolutely no expectation of winning. She wasn't crazy. Like, she knew. But just to show other black people in Mississippi that they could get involved. They could do it. And actually to show them that if a black person was ever going to get involved, they would have to register to vote. You know, if only white people are voting, Fannie Lou Hamer's not going to get elected, is she? And so you have to get involved if this is ever going to be a reality. It was kind of a demonstration, but it wasn't she wasn't expecting to win. Anyway, so finally, I think in terms of the light, what's this light in this little light of mine was love of her enemies. Now, this is something that she was known for. You see an amazing awareness that she had that white people resisting civil rights were the ones that really needed help. Now, that's not necessarily what everyone would conclude. She didn't just want to defeat people, she wanted to reach them. And her biographer, Kay Mills, the one who wrote this book here, I think this is here, yeah. Referring to another friend, she has a lot of accounts of friends who were reminiscing about Fannie Lou Hamer. The first time Eunita Blackwell, later a dear friend and civil rights ally, met Miss Hamer, she heard the story about the brutal treatment she had received. This was referring to a time when she was imprisoned and beaten in jail over the course of a number of days. She could just keep you spellbound. I was so angry that day listening to all her stuff. And she said, "Baby, you have to love them." I said, "This woman is crazy." She explained it to me that we have to love them and they are sick. That was a continuous thing. She kept that going, that they were sick and America was sick and it needed a doctor and we was the hope of America. Right? The Reverend Edwin King, who also knew Fannie Lou Hamer, says this. I think, yeah, here. She questioned many things about the misuse of power in this land, things many of us are still afraid to understand. But hatred of enemies, hatred of whites, or any person she resisted. I feel sorry for anyone that could let hate wrap them up. She used to say, "Ain't no such thing as I can hate anybody and hope to see God's face." That's worth putting on your wall.
Yeah.
So clearly, letting her light shine was a costly thing. It's not a cute kid song. It's a costly thing. If we think about all the implications of letting her light shine, it's a song of determination and renewed determination again and again. And it was a reminder of her calling and an encouragement to other people to accept the same calling. And so in a way, this little song, very simple, carried a huge weight in terms of the implications. Moving on to one of the other reasons why gospel music or music from the black church tended to be so well suited to the civil rights movement. It was actually quite adaptable music. It could be adapted to the present need. A lot of older gospel songs were structured in such a way that the lyrics could be easily altered. There's sort of a repetitive refrain, but then each verse could be ad-libbed by a leader. And if the leader called out loud enough, everybody could follow along and know where the verse was going. So that's a very interesting technical thing about the music, which made it very adaptable to the particular cause. So, for instance, "This Little Light of Mine," you could sing any number of different verses to that song, starting with different words. So, "All over Mississippi, I'm gonna let it shine," for instance. This is one of the things that she would sing. "God is on our side, I'm gonna let it shine." And there's a lot of other examples of this. I'll just give a few. This is one of my favorite songs that I've come across or recordings. "Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around." This is a recording. This is not a 1960s recording. It's a much more recent recording by Sweet Honey and the Rock, which is a group of singers, all women, unbelievable talented singers. And the way they sing together is it has something of the looseness of a more informal, even though they're very trained and they're doing everything very carefully. Anyway, I'll shut up. I'll just play the song. So this is "Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around." And listen to all the different ways that you could just make up as many verses as you wanted to this song if you had the energy. Oops, not that one.
Turn me around,
I'm going to skip ahead to a little bit further ahead here for all of our sakes. Yeah. Sweet Honey in the Rock. Great singers. And they're really trying to capture something of what... they're in a sense very polished what they're doing, but they're trying to capture some of the looseness of what singing together might have been like. I think it's a good time to turn to this whole... I think there's two different kinds of perseverance that of the music encourages, basically. The perseverance to just keep going, and then the perseverance to not retaliate with violence. So there's two different kinds of perseverance, to not give up, keep pushing, and then not give in to the very real temptation to retaliate. Both take a huge amount of strength, different kinds of strength, I think, and courage. So the first one, just keep going. Keep marching, keep protesting, don't be intimidated, don't be satisfied with half measures. This is something various people in power are always trying to satisfy the movement with half measures. If you are scared by the dogs or the fire hoses or the tear gas or the jail cells and you go home, then I think there was an awareness that a huge opportunity for change would be lost. If people just turned around, if they let all those things turn them around, right? Everything will go back to the way that it always has been, maybe worse. And so there was a sense that the time was now, it was ripe, change was not going to wait, there was no turning back. And I'm convinced that the singing helped people keep going. Communal song in the face of fear and discouragement is a really empowering thing. And I think you can feel that in the song we just heard. The way it builds. One of the verses of We Shall Overcome is, "We are not afraid." That's one of the things that people sang, and that was a word of defiance to the world, that we're not going to give up and go home, we're not going to be intimidated, and a word of encouragement for people to actually keep doing that. And and of course people were afraid, but singing together while they marched helped them keep going, even though they were afraid. And so this kind of power that music often has, a sense of unity, common purpose, common perseverance, courage in the face of resistance, It's one of the social characteristics of corporate singing. It happens in all kinds of different contexts. But there is also the theological content of the songs. And so I think knowing the context of the God of the Bible was with them was another thing that helped people have the nerve to keep going. And we've already talked about this a little bit. But the other great... I'll just go back. Theologically speaking, people who believe the words to these songs, the songs help remind them that actually victory is certain. Now, maybe not while I'm alive, but Martin Luther King's great statement that the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice, is this thing that's only the case because God is a God of justice, and He will one day bring about perfect justice. So even if you were to die in the struggle, you would die on the right side and on the winning side, right? So that is a very, very important part of I think, what helps people to keep going. People who believed in what they were singing. I mean, but then the other aspect of perseverance was the commitment to nonviolence. I think Martin Luther King's interest in the writings of Gandhi and how effective Gandhi's peaceful resistance was. It's well known that Martin Luther King was very interested in that. But to a lot of people today who do not particularly like Christianity, people like to forget that Martin Luther King was a Christian minister. And his sense of his calling was rooted very firmly in biblical teaching. And so I think for Christians in the civil rights movement, both white and black, Jesus' command to love your enemies and do good to those that hate you was front and center in terms of a motivation for not retaliating with violence. One of the distinctly Christian forms of nonviolent protest was the attempt to appeal to the Christian conscience of white people in power. Because in a lot of these places, nearly everybody in the South was a Christian, at least in name, was a Christian. And so, were white Christians willing to view black Christians as their brothers and sisters in Christ and accept the implications of what that might mean in this life? So there's a series of really fascinating signs where there's no color line in heaven. And there's another one here. The images aren't terribly good, but can a man love God and hate his brother? And then there's, over here, it's partially obscure, but it says, we are one in Christ Jesus. And so this is a very strategic and very wise thing to do. It's like, hey, wait a second. We're all claiming to be Christians here, right? You have a Christian conscience. I have a Christian conscience. What do you make of this? How do you square the lack of justice that you're perpetuating with your own Christian faith? Actually, it's kind of a way of shaming people a little bit, which is in a productive way, in a good way. Your own beliefs should shame you right now. And Fannie Lou Hamer, again, back to her as one of the amazing sort of embodiments of peaceful resistance. I'm going to read another quote from her. It's a long one, sorry, but this is again in her biography. This is talking about how she would very often train groups of volunteers coming down from the north, didn't know what they were getting into, but they wanted to help. And she would get them all together and speak to them and try to prepare them for what they were heading into. She sang and she tutored. She represented the grassroots, telling the volunteers things they needed to know about the people with whom they were about to work and live. Above all, our religion is very important to us. You'll have to understand that. If they did, she indicated, they would also understand that they were the answer to the faith of the people in Sunflower County. Hatred should have no place in your thoughts, she told them, just as hatred had no place in hers. Hatred of black for white solved nothing, she said, adding, the white man is the scaredest person on earth. Out in daylight, he don't do nothing, but at night he'll toss a bomb or pay someone to kill him. The white man's afraid he'll be treated like he's been treating the Negroes. But I couldn't carry that much hate. It wouldn't solve any problems for me to hate whites because they hate me. Oh, there's so much hate. Only God has kept the Negro sane. Help us communicate with white people, Mrs. Hamer said during one session held in paralyzing heat. Regardless of what they act like, there's some good there. How can we say we love God and hate our brothers and sisters? We've got to reach them. If only the people coming down can help us reach them. So she's talking to white people from the north saying, can you help us reach the white people here? Which is really, really interesting. But it's because she has a vision of them as not being holy, broken and fallen and beyond hope, right? She actually wants to see them redeemed. So she seems to have really taken into herself it's Paul's words in Romans 12. So this is something I'll just read as really one of the things that's rooting the biblical stance for not retaliating against our enemies. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, it is mine to avenge. I will repay, says the Lord. On the contrary, if you love your if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So this amazing, very biblical teaching that God is the judge. The battle is His. Vengeance is His. And actually this confidence in the final judgment of God is really the most potent thing that allows Christians to lay the sword down themselves, right? Because God is going to even the score someday. And Mephistopheles Hamer really got this. She was a hero of the civil rights movement. I think more people should view her as a hero of the faith. Look back to heroes of the faith. She's one of the heroes of the faith for me. In terms of her conviction of what was true, commitment to her calling, whether she liked doing what she was doing or not, her willingness to stand up and get knocked down again and again and again, similar series of hardships to the Apostle Paul when he lists the things that happened to him, commitment to love her enemies, and a contempt for death, which is something that people often talk about. The early Christians who were being persecuted had a contempt for death, meaning I could die, but that's not the fear of death is not going to stop me from doing what I need to do, right? So I just want to move now to just play a couple more songs that we can listen to, just to give you a sense that it wasn't all music from the Black Church. It was some other things. One of the songs I want to play very briefly is from Nina Simone, and then the very last song I want to play is from the Staple Singers. The Staple Singers were an interesting group because they were a gospel group, a family, but recorded on a record label that. They recorded some more controversial things, and they were writing songs in response to the time. So, first of all, this is Fannie Lou Hamer again. There's Nina Simone, and we'll listen to this song now. Oh, no. Not that one. Sorry. I hope the piano gets louder than that. Something is wrong with this recording. I'm not sure what's happened to the piano. Oh, shoot. To be free. Wish I could bring all change to me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud and say them clear. For the whole world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. 1967, sort of like musically kind of like a gospel song, definitely a song of longing. In the same year, the Staple Singers recorded this one. This song is called "Why Am I Treated So Bad?" And after this song is done, I think I'll just open it up for discussion, and then we can talk for as long as anyone wants to talk. But this is an interesting song because it's a response to what they're seeing around them. These are gospel singers, but singing about what they're seeing around them. It's not a traditional old song. It's something they wrote. And begins with Pop Staples, the guy who's leading the band. That's the dad there with the guitar. Sort of preaches a little bit for the first 30 seconds or so.
Song.
There's obviously a lot more to say, but I've already gone very late, so I apologize for that. And I just want to open it up for any conversation that can happen now. Maybe I'll go back and put up some pictures to look at. So anybody that wants to have a question or reflections or objections or whatever. Yeah, my friend.
Just a comment. I was struck how the songs, when you were just talking about how, you know, the idea of they really united people, many people knew the word. I was thinking about the picture, or just the idea in the Old Testament of an Ebenezer and the stones of remembrance, and the command in the Old Testament to remember, and just thinking how this. It just seems to me, in listening to you talk, that these songs in many ways were like a very tangible talisman to kind of always kind of keep like the vision of the kingdom and the truth of who God is and the things that he has promised. You know, that not only, I love the Mahalia Jackson song and that idea of like, the amazing picture, right, of the coronation. And, so not only, you know, the picture of the kingdom that is to come, this idea of this very clear picture of who God is, of who he has said he is, who he has shown himself to be, you know, over time, I mean, who he's been. And so, in a way, I just in my own personal life and faith walk, I feel like I'm always, I pray very often for a better memory, and I pray for God to help me remember, because I don't think I do a very good job at it, and I feel like I need physical things sometimes, really physical things that I can touch to sort of help me kind of keep the right vision in front of me. And I was just thinking how the songs really serve that purpose in a way, and these things very tangible to kind of keep in front of their eyes at all times, the picture of where they have come, but the truth of who God is.
Yeah, what is ultimately true in the face of all kinds of things that would make that hard to believe, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So the things that you actually are seeing and experiencing.
I mean, that's the song "How I Got Over" talking about the, you know, Jesus who bled and died and suffered for me. So like the suffering God, but then it's the great coronation. He's actually Jesus is king right now, actually the one who's with us right now, and you might not, unless you had the Bible to tell you that and songs to remind you that, you might not remember. Any other thoughts? Danny.
I was really struck with, this is like area of music that I was really unfamiliar with, but very struck by the way that the artists of the time, like Jim Baez, for instance, or Bob Dylan, reacted to cultural events that were happening right then. And it was popular then. And so I began thinking, you know, this battle is not over. It's continuing today. Why don't we see the pop artists today?
We do. And it's a really interesting thing. And this is something that I'm not as equipped to talk about, just because I'm not as up to speed with contemporary music as I am with old gospel music. I mean, there's in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement, music has played quite a part in that. Although it's playing a different role than music played in the Civil Rights Movement. And this is for those of you who know Emmett Price, I emailed Emmett about a month ago, saying like, Emmett, help me out with this lecture. he sent me back a very helpful email. But one of his observations was that the music, the songs like the song "Freedom" and the song "Formation" by Beyonce, songs by Kendrick Lamar, like "All Right," are significant to people in the Black Lives Matter movement. Although, one thing that he observed was that they don't function as, they can't really function as music that's corporately sung together. They're a bunch of individuals who like the music and it speaks to them, and they're bound together by their concern for what's happening in the world and how that music sort of articulates the problem to them. But it's not actually in the same way binding people together in the way that corporately sung music can do. And so yeah, it's music is playing a role, but I'm unclear as to exactly how. Certainly if you take the time to go and watch the video for All Right, which is a Kendrick Lamar song, it's very disturbing. It's very, very in response to police brutality, police shootings. And the words are in the video is, you know, and not without some spiritual hope in it. Actually, that song is a really interesting song, but it's not offering the same kind of depth of spiritual hope that some of these gospel songs are. Any other thoughts on that? Because there's a lot of music, contemporary music, that I'm pretty unfamiliar with. But yeah, Lulu.
This was for me, and it was different. I'm not answering your question. I don't know either. I want to talk about what you just, shared with us. For me, it was a time of reflection, because I grew up in segregated South, and so quite familiar with the music, so it was just wonderful hearing the music, the gospel music, and being a product of the 60s, in the South Carolina, being, raised in that time and experiencing a lot of it, it is just a kind of reflection.
Yeah, okay. I'm glad. Thank you. Yes, sir.
In our lunch discussion today, Jeff basically asked, what do we do?
Yeah.
What do we do in response to current events? And what does the church do?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to hear other people's thoughts on that.
Yeah.
But I was struck just in your timeline of how locally people were acting, and how small and massive at the same time those things must have been.
Yeah.
And now, in the scope of history, we see how massive those actions were.
Yeah.
Like throwing huge boulders
into
a pond, with the triple effect.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like I get so stuck in feeling like I don't know where this touches down. Here in
Southborough,
in my day in and day out. So I don't know. I would love to exercise our collective imagination.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do?
What do we do?
How do we foster a collective memory, even?
Yeah.
So that we have some sense of how what has happened, how have we gotten to where we are in the good sense, and how far we have to go. One of my thoughts at the end of our discussion was at the very least, and maybe it's not just the least, maybe it's the most in some ways, the church, the all of us church, we have to lament and grieve these things, and actually learning gospel music through you has been such a gift to me as a musical tradition and a way of praying, a way of bringing lament into church. And I just think how rare it is in most church services, for there to even be space for that.
Any thoughts? Anna? Yeah.
I don't have an answer. I just have another question.
Okay.
Kind of just don't get this here. But I just kind of realizing, sitting here, that watching some of the news about maybe a sexual assault survivor not being hear you correctly, I immediately think, okay, my friends who experience this are going to be affected by this especially.
Mm-hmm.
Or with the Orlando shooting, I thought of my friends who are gay lesbian and reached out to a couple of them.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm realizing that, you know, with the recent events, it hasn't come to my mind like, oh, I should reach out to my friends who are African American. This might be affected.
Yeah.
And so kind of again, like, what's there that's like using their collective imagination, like, what is it that should we say something? Because that sounds to me so hard.
Mm-hmm.
Easy, but also hard for the ones who shouldn't be simply to you.
Yeah.
What should we say?
Well, anybody interrupt me at any moment. It seems that in all of the discussion about the particular cases of shootings, of police officers shooting black people, there's information flying in every direction, and it's confusing, and I have a brother who's a police officer, and I know that some situations which are really scary, there's split-second decisions that are made, and, you know, police officers can make bad mistakes. But all of those complications aside, and potential ways in which maybe the shooting might not have been completely racially motivated or whatever, we have to be able to say, I think particularly as white Christians, it's wrong when a white police officer shoots a black person. And just say it. In a sense, it's not that this is the world stage here, this is a Libri lecture, but to explicitly condemn it. And to try to, as much as we can, share some of the anger. Because this is something that, if unity of all believers means something, unity between white people and black people who are under Christ, we should be, because God is angered by things like this, we should all be angered by things like this. So anger is appropriate response. And my this is a generalization, but my sense is that not enough white people are angry enough about this. Right? go ahead.
I was just going to say, but again, learning from the civil rights movement, there's appropriate anger, but non-violent. I mean, what happened in Dallas was horrendous violence in response, and that was so totally, I think what the thing you said in the beginning, had Martin Luther King begun the civil rights movement the way Dallas,
mm-hmm.
What happened in Dallas yesterday, would never happen.
Yeah.
When it would have been a disaster.
Would have imploded from the start.
Of non-violence, the power of even loving your enemies.
Yeah.
Danny Wilhamer is. There was one of the things that was in the news this morning. And again, I think you don't get lots of details. One problem, you don't get lots of details in the news, and you often get a slant, but. In the shooting, the windows of a 7-Eleven were busted,
mm-hmm.
and people started looting.
Mm-hmm.
And police, something like 40 police officers just stood to stop the looting,
mm-hmm.
stood together arm in arm.
Mm-hmm.
And the people looting were screaming obscenities at them, and actually mocking the fact that police officers were killed, sort of rejoicing in the fact that
they
were killed. And I was just thinking, I don't know how they responded. But the power of a quiet response, there's such power. If they stood there and continued to do their job without screaming back or retaliating for them, they didn't take out guns. There's such power in dignity in nonviolent response to evil.
To me, this is one of the reasons why it's so important to look back at the history of the civil rights movement and to see not just the way in which nonviolent resistance was true and right and good and honoring to God, but also effective.
Powerful.
It was effective. Because, like you were saying, even just some of those images of the sit-ins, of people sitting at the counter, the images speak volumes in terms of the moral stature of the person who's not retaliating, right? And the moral weakness of the people that are bullying them. And I think that has it's a very different kind of power than exerting force back, which ultimately, I mean, this is the thing that is so scary about right now, about what happened in Dallas, and it's appropriate to lament this and to be scared, to cry out to God for this, because what we need to pray for is against the escalation that'll happen. This causes that, and even in a city where, according to someone I was talking to recently, the Dallas Police Department, as police departments go, was actually doing a fairly good job over the past few years. And
police was a black man.
Yeah. Very well spoken. And so it's tragic both for the people who were killed, but just for the likelihood that this will now escalate. Because over the past number of years, I think my sense is that a lot of black men are more afraid to get in the car and drive. How many white people here are afraid of what's going to happen if they get pulled over by a cop when next time they drive? Probably not much. We also don't want police officers to be afraid. Because when police officers are afraid, that's when they do really bad stuff, right? Bob. Yeah.
Well, that's what we're used to. Situations, when I look at that picture, that's a great picture, by the way.
That's what, yeah, I love it.
I think about the times, how they changed so much, and how they haven't changed at all.
Yeah.
I think about this discussion that we all have, as far as in black men and women, yeah, with our sons, in fact, especially with my son, about, the strict rules on what you do when you're soft or when you're federal policeman, you put your hands on the wheel, you don't reach for anything.
Yeah.
Because I'm scared. I'm afraid that he's going to make the wrong move and he's going to speak that to an officer or something.
Yeah.
Something's going to happen. That's happened to, it's happened to me when I was younger.
Yeah.
But it hasn't happened as I've grown older. But it goes back to the same situation of making the officer, my instruction is to make the officer feel comfortable.
Yeah.
Make him feel, to your point,
he's
not afraid of anything.
Yeah.
Go on. But and I get back to those days, what happened back in the day, so to speak, is that, as we said, that everybody knew those songs and everybody grasped them, and every word was important. So it's quite something. Like I said, the more it's changed, the more it's interesting.
Yeah.
But I am struck also by the pastor on the left there. He is into
the song. He's loving it. I don't know if he knows the song, but he loves it. That's why I chose it. I love it. I mean, this is one of the things. A lot of the pictures you find of people singing "We Shall Overcome," they're not just holding hands; they're crossing hands and holding hands, which means that you have to be really close to the person next to you. And that's actually a beautiful thing. Yeah, Gloria. Yeah.
Thank you for your research. And I appreciate your title, Music and the Civil Rights Movement. I took copious notes. it's kind of like the modern civil rights movement, because at least I'm in the 20th century, so Japan, Africanism, and Deputy Boys of Booker T. Washington. So it's just like the modern.
Sure,
And I grew up on all that timeline, and we traveled south to visit my grandparents, and I never experienced any discrimination. They shielded us. But I remember all those events Yeah. And I grew up in the North, in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. So we sang those songs, and we went to 12th Baptist Church.
Yeah.
And we stayed out for freedom. We stayed out in 1863. Mm-hmm. But anyway, all those songs had meaning for us, too.
Mm-hmm.
And we all knew the words, and we all sang together. And there's something about singing together. And
yep.
It kind of unifies you. You know, I'm not going to comment on this week's event, sorry,
mm-hmm.
but I appreciate your research,
yeah.
And thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. And Marty.
Yeah, one of the songs that you didn't mention it today, but it's one of the songs we think we do send teachers with gospel music here on Monday morning. So we have time for prayer and singing, and part of the singing is gospel music. But one of the ones we sing, which I think came from the story, is I Don't Feel No Ways Tired.
Well, it's in the 70s, yeah. A little later in the 70s, yeah.
Yeah.
Can you comment? Because that, that, you know, that's what it struck me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't feel no
ways tired. It looks like we should probably just sing the song, huh? Well, that's it. That song is from a little late. It's from the 1970s. James Cleveland, I think. Is that right? But it's very much the same kind of message, right? Is that we're like still in trouble, but we've been brought a long, long way. And let's not forget that we've been brought a long, long way. And the same God that brought us that distance is still with us. So, yeah.
I don't feel no ways tired. Well, they were tired. They were exhausted. I mean, mm-hmm. But it's the sense that the singing energized sort of made you not feel your tiredness. And made you know you're on the right track.
Should we sing it? I don't know. I don't have the. We'll just. Just do it.
Daunted by the many, many sides of things that happen. desperate need. Helping police, be better policemen.
Mm-hmm.
Inner city issues, yeah, are just endless. But I think we can feel too helpless if we think we've got to have a whole solution or do something in a whole.
Yeah.
And I think if we think of doing something for a piece of it, that'll take us further along than being sort of paralyzed by looking at the whole,
mm-hmm,
and thinking we've got to have a magnificent solution with our arms around the whole thing.
Yep.
And there's an enormous amount to be done in all these things, but I think if we think of, you know, we're pretty limited, each one of us.
Yeah.
Small.
Yeah.
And but together, I mean, that's the whole thing you've done. Together, a lot can be done.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe just think small for a bit in terms of what we can actually do.
Yeah. But Addie, did you have something you wanted to say? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm looking at that picture.
Yeah.
And you can see, look like they're snuggling together.
Mm-hmm.
And the little children in the front.
Yeah. Where
they can, like, protect the children.
Yeah.
And back in those times, they didn't have any law.
Mm-hmm.
Or justice on their side.
Mm-hmm.
They had nothing but themselves and God.
Mm-hmm.
They had to have the love of God.
Mm-hmm.
They had a lot of faith.
Mm-hmm.
Christianity was the thing that they had to, they depend on, you know.
Yeah.
And then even in those songs, when you hear the song, they sing, I got over.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I got over. It was only through God.
Yeah.
How they got over.
Yeah.
That's the only thing they could look at, you know.
Yeah.
There were no, you could never go to courthouse.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or have anybody to speak up or to say anything.
Yeah.
I imagine there were some few, like had to be,
mm-hmm,
some white folks said something. You know, but they had to, mm-hmm, say that also, why?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they too, the one that wanted to kind of say something,
mm-hmm,
they were afraid to talk.
Yeah.
They couldn't say anything.
Yeah.
But they will say some few things that also hope blacks to get over.
Mm-hmm.
Or to even get ready to vote, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But that was also kept quiet.
Yeah.
Because, mm-hmm, I used to hear my mom talk about shell stories. I was born and raised back in Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
So she could always tell a story about her day, her time.
Yeah.
She was born in 1905. And she had seen a lot, went through a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Got up in the morning time and go to work at 6 in the morning, mm-hmm, and went until they couldn't see, she said, dog.
Mm-hmm.
And they get paid 50 cents.
Yeah.
Well, that's almost all the money they had to pay in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
People who had the plantation, the land, they didn't have any money either,
mm-hmm,
until the crops were gathered and whatever. Mm-hmm. Then they had money, just like the blacks had money.
Yeah.
Of course, the blacks didn't have any, because they was already working on the white folks' farm and the plantation, what they call it.
Yeah.
And it was really, really hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So black folks, they prayed. And you know, prayer, I faithfully believe in prayer today.
Yeah.
And that's what brought them a long way. They faith in God.
Yeah.
That's what brought them. They faith in God. They trust in God. And they live in light. So God made a way.
Yeah.
And brought them out of that abundance of slavery.
Yeah.
Just the same.
Yeah.
And that's how it really
arrives.
You know. And I remember going back to someone said, going back to Alabama. I'm driving back with my husband, myself, and two little children. Sometimes you stop in a gas station, and they would not send you gas.
Yeah.
You couldn't get gas.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like the big freeways now you have, you know, then we didn't have that big thing like that. So we'd be out there, so anytime you got, you always keep your tank full.
Yeah.
You got to stop at every station, get some gas.
But yeah, because you never know when you won't be able to get
it. Didn't sell you gas.
Yeah.
You didn't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
Because you had, you know, gas enough to go to the next station.
Yeah.
So it was really hard.
Yeah.
And I was driving in that myself, and I would go in to get the coffee, because my husband, you know, there was really a prejudice against black men.
Mm-hmm.
Black women could do a little more.
Mm.
But the black man, he's driving, you're waiting in the car, and your wife's going to get the coffee.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, we had our lunch and stuff, you know, but sometimes you want something hot or whatever.
Yeah.
You go in and you get served. And I used to wonder to myself, why is it so hard for the white to, why do they hate the black man so bad?
Mm-hmm.
Why do they hate my husband so bad? That was something like that. You know?
Yes.
I wonder that. Yeah. But they would, you know, be a little more patient with the women. That way. And I think so God brought people to in those times. It was God. It was a faith in God.
Yeah.
No matter through all that, what they were going through, killing their husbands or whatever it was, my mom seen some of that herself, and she tells us about it. But they had to endure it. Nothing they could do.
Yeah.
Persevere.
Yeah.
Continue to pray. Meet out on that little church yard they had. Scared to death.
Yeah.
Everybody was. They don't know when they're coming back, or when one might come back away, or shoot up people. But and they would pray it through, and just trust God.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's what brought people back in those days. It had to be the faith in God.
Yeah.
God brought them through.
Yeah.
That's what it was. So we still have to do it today.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We still got to pray.
Yeah.
We really got to do it.
Because, I mean, in a sense, the when there's no court of appeal, you know, there's nowhere to go with a problem except to the throne of God, which is the only court of appeal available, because God listens and God sees.
So just when we realize if there's no answer, we can give.
Is there
an answer?
Yeah. Not one easy answer. No. Reverend Lloyd, did you have something you would say?
No, just look. You did a great job tonight.
Oh, thank you.
I want you to know that.
Thanks for coming.
Very good job. One of the things that I guess I've always been struck, you did a good job tonight in showing that when you talk about music, whether it's from slavery and then the adaptation of that during civil rights, and I think it even has some damage today in terms of the nature of what's going on and the adaptation of music within the sense of struggle.
Yeah.
I think it still needs to be fleshed out as to, and that's usually done in hindsight anyway, not during the struggle, it's after you evaluate and say, oh, this is what this has meant to us, given us meaning, so we shall see somewhere down the future in terms of the present day. Yeah. But one of the things about it is that the nature for which that music is a catharsis for souls that are scarred.
Yeah.
And that is for those who experience outright in terms of what it means to be on one side of the coin or the other side. Mm-hmm. So that you talk about folk being able to say, okay, I'm a white American and I can identify, or I'm seeking to identify with what that is. And the process of doing it is through the music.
Mm-hmm.
And that same song means something different for a person who's an African American who's suffering under racism, oppression, or whatever.
Yeah.
But that soul being scarred in that process. And that's what we got going on today, too.
Yeah.
And that's how we're feeling a little bit up today as we think of what's happened in 3 days of violence, the loss of life, and our sense of our soul being scarred and not showing how we do solve any side to it. You know what I mean? And that's where we're all struggling right here, and we will be for some time.
Yeah.
But music. Has a role in that, and I want to encourage you that if I have enough time, I'll ask you to say, okay, now Ben, tell us from your time that you started doing your homework for tonight, what out of that has gotten you to the point to say, you know, I never understood this about my journey, but now I do. It may be why maybe you'll, shall we say, sing a new song.
Thank you. Thank you, Reverend Lloyd. I think that's music as catharsis for the scarred soul. I think that's very true. I don't know if I can answer your question just now, but although I will say that one of the songs that has been with me as I've been preparing for this is the one we listened to, that Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around. And something about the conviction that ultimately comes from knowing that God is with you, but that kind of there's an incredible perseverance or drive in that song, determination to keep going no matter what, that I find so No, this is very, very, it's very moving to me, and very, and I guess one of the first things I said in the lecture was, sometimes we're moved by pictures of moral excellence when we see somebody up against a huge obstacle, and in this case, because of their faith, overcome. To me, that is a reminder of the goodness of God. That God is actually really there. And so I find that song, as well as most of these songs, deeply encouraging to my faith, even though I don't share the same story. I've had some connection with folks at GSCC, but I don't. It's not my story. But it's I've definitely felt more connected to Black people's experience through the music. Absolutely. Yes. Any other thoughts there?
I just going back to Sarah's question and Jeff's question, like what do we do? I just wanted to share something that's been significant for me in the last couple of months. I'm part of a women's small group Bible study that we've been together for a couple of years, and we go to two different churches actually. It's not just from one church, but the other church, not my church, but the other church that's represented. Back in the late winter, their pastor did a sermon on racism and racial inequality. And some of the women in my study who participated in that church were, that was a significant thing for them, and they really felt like it was sort of this moment. And then that was, then they moved on in the sermon series. Mm-hmm. And we want more. And just thinking about, especially so much with the Black Lives Matter movement and how it, just the importance of talking with, but mostly listening to people who are different from us and hearing their stories and believing their stories. Mm-hmm. And so we decided as a group the last couple months that we wanted in our study to just look and think about this idea of racism. And we put something out on the church board. And so we gathered a group of women, and three of us were white, three were Asian, two were African-American, and one was Latina. Mm-hmm. And we chose a book that we had mixed feelings about, but it was just a starting point. It's the, mm-hmm. the Jim Wallace's book called The Original America's Original Sin. It just was published earlier this year. Mm-hmm. But it was a good jumping off point. It has a great study guide with it, and there were a lot of resources that came with it as far as videos. And one of the things that was really powerful is that we all took, I think it's either out of Harvard or BU, but some researchers have put together something called the implicit bias test. Mm. And you go online and you can take the test for free. It takes about 20 minutes. And it was just a really, we all took it. Mm-hmm. It kind of gives you a read on kind of what your racial bias is. Which was an interesting thing. And anyway, it's been a small step, but it's just been a helpful thing to sort of have this group of people who come from different racial backgrounds and to just mm-hmm. kind of start sharing stories and asking questions and just talking to one another.
Yeah.
And again, just as to Sarah's point, it's small. It's, you know, there's what, nine of us, or I mean, it's just a small group. But just that practice of like, of telling stories and listening to one another mm-hmm. and asking questions together, and we finished about 2 weeks ago, and all of us feel like, so again, we're not done with that. We want to keep doing.
Yeah.
You know, so we're just talking about what are things kind of community wise that mm-hmm. we can do together. We're going to do. I don't know where we'll land with it, mm-hmm. but it's just been a helpful space,
mm-hmm.
I guess, to just have some conversations and, if nothing else, a space to kind of talk about what we're seeing.
Yeah. Yeah. The more just friendships there can be in between white people and black people, the more we will to your point, Anna, the more we will, when something like that happens when we see something on the news, the more we'll think about our friends, right? And have conversations with the people we know, short of having some massive solution to the whole problem, like you were saying, Dick. I think for white people, particularly for white people, just to listen a lot, I think, these times, because I appreciate your comment, Bob, and what you were saying about your experience that you know, I have a son. He's nowhere near driving age yet, but there's amazing. It's amazing the things that white people don't have to think about, right? And don't think about it. And I think it's just, I think it's.
But we don't even know not to think about it.
Right.
I was in high school in the early 70s.
Yeah.
And in English classrooms, the required text for at least my class was Black Like Me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I, that was just.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up here.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah. So we need to hear the experiences of of our brothers and sisters.
I could just say one more thing.
Yeah.
That's Reverend Lloyd. Right?
Oh, yeah.
I just would talk about it. I didn't even realize that I know. way back when, I don't know how many years ago, he spoke here.
Mm-hmm.
And I always have been struck by the words he said, the call to worship.
Mm-hmm.
And then I always have continue to just have a total different sense of that now. Mm-hmm. And just the call to worship was working in the field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it had to be a secret church meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't, you know, hey, we've got to go at 8 o'clock. It was a secret call to worship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So those threads, you know, that music, that spiritual, that was. Is key, was key, mm-hmm. will be key, you know? Mm-hmm. And the hope is good, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and do you have a comment? Did you raise your hand? Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. If I could, I want to say thanks.
Sure.
And I also want to say thanks for those who were able to share that was the time of reflection. Mm-hmm. Just being in the same room would be very lucky that mistake. Mm-hmm. To the corner, Janelle Monáe, you might know from that fun song, the group fun, mm-hmm. Has a How You Tombout, Houtombout, and it's this, are you familiar with the song?
I'm familiar with her, but not that song, yeah.
The words are just How You Tombout, and then it's Eric Garner says his name, Tamir Rice says his name, it just goes through all of
this.
Names, her name, and I think in that, there's this, thing that we're kind of talking about, but is a witness,
mm-hmm.
what it is to witness, and it's, I know it's not a church song, perhaps, in that it doesn't have these references that we might associate, but there's a theologian named Shelley Rambo who talks about trauma,
mm-hmm.
And sort of, she talks about the Holy Saturday and the Triduum of Easter,
mm-hmm.
What is it to bear witness to the scar or to trauma, and
mm-hmm.
to not have things resolved in the resurrection of Sunday, not rushing to that
mm-hmm.
resurrection,
mm-hmm.
Not being caught up in just the pain of Good Friday, but in the real ambiguity of Holy Saturday. And I think, as another white guy, but for Christians in general too, I think there's something to not trying to fix the whole thing, which is a little bit has been said already, but.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not necessarily acknowledging that there can be something we can do. And in some ways, maybe helpfully saying a bit less and not trying to be the fixer, trying to get away from the Protestant work ethic kind of thing. But to, you know, just to bear witness and to, you know, to say it's wrong and to say, I
mm-hmm.
see you. I think it's really big. And I think we have pop songs like that because the church, in some ways, hasn't been able to bear
mm-hmm.
that witness. Or we haven't been able to bear with
the white church
our own
yeah.
system
yeah.
to our own traumas,
yeah.
let alone our national traumas.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe one more comment, and then
what has struck me throughout this whole recent event is how much we need each other.
Mm-hmm.
Not only as Christians, but as Americans.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we protect each other. So, as a white woman, I have had problems in my life because I had black people helping me, and I was treated with, you know, I had that help taken away from me because my parents
mm-hmm.
didn't want
me to be associated with mm-hmm. people helping me. Mm-hmm. It can happen that way around, and yeah. we need each other.
Yeah.
I found a quilt pattern from the 1800s called the Underground Railroad. Mm-hmm. And the quilt pattern is very mathematically pure. Mm-hmm. It's both black and white in equal amounts. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of see sort of plaid pattern with mm-hmm. the squares. But you, neither black nor white stands out more than the other. You need to have those both in the mm-hmm. pattern to see the pattern mm-hmm. and to make it what it is. Mm-hmm. And it's like the black squares define the white squares and the white squares define the black squares. Mm-hmm. And there's no way you could take them apart.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have a picture if you want.
Mm-hmm. Which is a... somehow Sunday morning being such a segregated hour of the week is a picture of incompletion. Somehow, this is—I mean, it's what to do? Go to a black church. I don't know. my family—I don't know when it was when we started going to GFCC. Mid-90s or something.
You started in middle school.
Yeah. As I mean, I kind of tagged along with my parents because I didn't really know what was happening. But to me, that, there's something deeply wrong with the almost zero contact we have with our brothers and sisters in Christ of a different race. And that's something that we can do something about.
And different. Rich, different Christian tradition.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's not just a novel cultural experience, but actually something that can very, very much deepen your faith. But yeah, in the way back there, so
yeah. I was thinking of how this could tie in with the lecture that we had 2 weeks ago, I think, on Irish monasticism in community. And thinking a little bit of what Mary Frances was saying in her experience, and also Mr. Keyes and how he was saying that it can be the sort of overwhelming urge to try to wrap everything in our arms, try to take everything in, but that's not possible.
Yeah.
And listening to Mary Frances and how she was saying, so what she did was she found some friends, and they made their own community, mm-hmm. and they made their own spot of worship,
mm-hmm.
and their own place to explore these ideas. And sort of thinking of that idea of like the monastic model and how to reach out in community and to purposely choose to build relationships and to purposely choose to make friends,
mm-hmm.
and to start that conversation or continue the conversation, I mm-hmm. should say, in very local, very neighborhood sort of ways, and then take that to the church mm-hmm. as well. But I think maybe sort of the presuppositions and the atmosphere of the church can sometimes cloud the conversation a little bit,
yeah.
and maybe if we start it outside and then take in, we'll have sort of a fresh look on things.
So by monastic tradition, you mean something that's sort of apart from the church, but something that's a community forming that's apart from the church, but could inform the church. So last comment, and then I'm going to... I forgot to mention that anyone who needs to leave during the discussion can. I should have said that at the beginning. But yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. No, I just wanted to say that you know, you raised the fact that we could do on to the white church. And for us, it was really a decision. We were challenged by reading the book More Than Equal by Chris White Rice, a white guy, and John and Spencer Perkins, a black guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a book about Rachel. They were involved in a ministry of racial reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things really hit me in that book, challenging in the book, but one of them was the need to be proactive. I used to go to a very white church and pray that some black people would come. And why would they want to come to the church up in Baltimore? And the need to be proactive to
actually, they made the distinction between racial equality as a legal thing and racial reconciliation as a personal thing.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, knowing, having black friends, you know, mm-hmm. having people you call up when you know they're in trouble or call you up. And,
mm-hmm.
and so the decision to go to GFCC and take you along, you know, really came out of that book. And one of the big things that challenged me in that book was the realization that, one of the ways they put it was, you can be white living in America and know nothing about black culture and just get along fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're black living in America, you need to know a lot about white culture to survive, much less to do, to, you know, just to survive, much less to do well.
Mm-hmm.
And the book was really helpful in making real to me the fact that the playing field is still very unequal.
Yeah.
And made me realize all sorts of things I've taken for granted that I've never, I'm not a racist, but just where I grew up,
mm-hmm.
privileges, and it actually brought back an incredibly painful memory of when I was a little girl in fifth mm-hmm. grade, and I had a very good friend named Patty Gordon, who was black.
Mm-hmm.
She was one of the few black families in this town on Long Island where I grew mm-hmm. up. And my parents had a sailboat, and in order to have a sailboat, you had to join the yacht club because you had to have a way, you had to have your boat at an anchor, mm-hmm. and you had to get on the launch to go to the boat, so you had to be a member of the yacht club. So my parents remember the yacht club. And Patty was at my house, I think I was in fifth grade. And it was hot, I said, let's go to the beach. And so we started going to the beach, and partway there she got something. And went home.
Mm-hmm.
And I got really upset. I mean, I didn't know, I felt badly, I went home, and I said, Mommy, you know, we can go to the beach. And Patty got a stomachache and went home. And my mother said to me, Patty didn't get a stomachache. Black people aren't allowed at the yacht club, and she knew that, and her parents had told her, and I phoned the yacht club, and I told them, my daughter's coming down with a black friend, don't anybody dare say anything.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, it was like what you would say to your son. But this woman, this is a woman I gave 50,
mm-hmm.
had to say to her children, these are the places you can't go.
Yeah.
Don't go to these places. And that mm-hmm. was just such an incredible eye-opener
yeah.
to me. But you know, years later reading this book made me aware of so many other privileges
yeah.
that I never knew had anything to do, that I never knew were privileges, and I never mm-hmm. knew had anything to do with color.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
the decision, it would have been really, really good for us is to be minorities
mm-hmm.
in a black church,
mm-hmm.
because we've learned so many things. We've learned a lot about worship, I can tell you that,
mm-hmm.
that we didn't know from, not to say we can't, there's not wonderful worship in lots of white churches, but we've heard a lot about worship we didn't have before. And it was also the first church we ever went to that had a place where your music was. But just listening
mm-hmm.
and being aware that nothing in the church catered to us, so we learned
mm-hmm.
hearing people's stories. Very different attitudes toward things like affirmative action. Then lots of people conversations I've been in the past,
mm-hmm.
you know, where people had academically talked about affirmative action, but once you experience
mm-hmm.
playing field isn't equal,
mm-hmm.
I have so many advantages,
mm-hmm.
my kids have advantages, and that, I mean, that's just one example, but
yep.
it's been incredibly helpful for us to be where we're minorities and where we accept it, amazingly,
because
mm-hmm. there's a grace in our play.
Mm-hmm.
People now we call black friends.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to
yeah.
give a little background
yeah.
about why we dragged you there.
No, that sounds like I had no interest in going. I was excited about going.
I just
didn't know what it was going to mean.
No, but it was actually pretty good. Pretty good.
I know. Well, I think we should wrap it up. Thank you so much for coming, and thank you for all the comments and.